Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It was 30 years ago this fall that a law professor from the University of Oklahoma testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee that the nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, had sexually harassed her while they both worked in the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Anita Hill told her story. Some believed, many others did not. And Justice Thomas was eventually confirmed 52-48. The toll was tough on Hill. She was forced out at the University of Oklahoma, eventually teaching at Brandeis University, where she's a university professor of social policy, law, women, and gender studies. But that moment was a landmark moment in U.S. history and inspired many others to come forward with their own stories, to file complaints, and to even run for office to change our society's resistance towards confronting gender-based violence. Anita Hill has been at the forefront of that movement ever since. In her new book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence, she relates the last 30 years of efforts and the documents the reluctance of government, education, judicial, military, and private sector institutions to truly confront and demand substantive change when it comes to gender violence and harassment. Anita Hill will be in conversation with Gloria Steinem in a Magic City Books special event tonight at 7, and she joins me today as my guest on Studio Tulsa. Professor Hill, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your program.
I would like to ask you about three words, a phrase that appears throughout Believing, your account of gender violence, and that phrase is, quote, not that bad, unquote, which was used by senators intent on elevating Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court back in 1991 when you testified to the harassment you experienced, and has shown up in varying guises in numerous other lawsuits and court proceedings on gender violence before and since. What do those three words mean to you and other survivors?
Well, it means that we're being dismissed, that our hurt and harm and suffering really is inconsequential to the person who is saying that to us, that they're not going to take it seriously enough to try to do anything about it. And it also means that they really aren't interested in hearing about what happens to us. I think that it not only is a message to people who are the direct victims, but I think it's a message to everyone else around them that sexual harassment and sexual abuse and assault and rape or intimate partner violence really is not an important issue and nothing that political figures and powerful people ought to be taking note of and ending.
What's really shocking is in the course of the book is how often a version of those words are invoked at what I can only say is truly heinous behavior. Was it shocking to you? I know you've spent the last 30 years working on this issue and trying to address some of these wrongs. Has it been shocking to you to see how often this is invoked by judges, by people of authority, by CEOs, by boards about CEOs? That it's not that bad. It's constantly used.
Well, I learned over time how shocking it was. When you initially hear it, you assume that this is just the way people think and that it's sort of the norm. But it is shocking how people do not understand the power of those words. We have something of an example of it that came out last month when the Olympic gymnast testified before Congress about how their complaints about abuse that at the hands of Dr. Larry Nassar were just dismissed, where one former gymnast, now a woman, but at the time was a 13-year-old girl, told an FBI agent about how she was abused. And at the end of her telling her story, after not having said anything to her At the end of telling it, he said to her, "Is that all?" And how that now that is still shocking. We're talking about a child. Right. We also know now that Larry Nassar went on to molest maybe as many as 100 other victims after the report went to the FBI, and perhaps even because the FBI failed to follow up on these gymnasts. Complaints.
Yeah, in fact, they virtually didn't even file a report of this encounter. It was completely discounted.
It was, and that is happening says that our institutions are failing us. Our institutions are failing us, and they're failing to stop serial behavior because they don't take the words of victim seriously. You know, when you think about some of the most notorious cases that we've had in the news for the past few years, it tend to involve multiple witnesses, and it takes multiple witnesses to get any kind of response that comes close to reckoning for this behavior. The most recent conviction of R. Kelly follows the same pattern. You know, this is a musician who had been accused of sexually assaulting a 13-year-old almost 3 decades ago, but it took years and different prosecutors and, you know, racketeering charges before these women were heard. These were mostly Black women, and the question that it raises is, not only were we dealing with misogyny in denying women's claims, but we perhaps were also not being believed because of our race. And I think there's a strong case to be made that race was a factor in R. Kelly not being prosecuted for years.
I find it also that...
So gender violence is a complex problem that we have to deal with on many levels. And cultural myths is one of the reasons that we haven't made more progress.
I think there's also an issue of we tend to discount the victim's veracity of the experience, and we discount the power structure between oftentimes the victim and the person being accused. That there are real consequences to the person coming forward, and there's a tendency to discount that power that is at play. It was at power in your testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee 30 years ago, because here it is, you're a law professor, and here is a sitting Court of Appeals judge who, even if he's not elevated to the Supreme Court, he's still going to have a great effect on your life. And I think there's this tendency to discount the power structures that are involved in a lot of these situations.
Well, and let me just add that that power structure included the power of the White House, who was his sponsor.
True.
So that we're not just talking about one-on-one, he's a more powerful man, and I was a woman that nobody had heard of before. 1991, we're talking about the power of the presidency, and in those Judiciary Committee hearings, the power of the president to actually control the FBI and to shape and limit the investigation really came through in the Christine Blasey Ford testimony and hearing for the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. So the imbalance was so acute that, you know, it's obvious. And in many ways, it's the same kind of power imbalance that occurs when someone who is a CEO of a corporation and the board of directors is backing that CEO, or someone who is a manager and, you know, his superiors are backing him, as opposed to the people who come forward and say that he's being abused. Very recently, even today, the reports of the American women's soccer players,
yes,
who have complained about a coach who was abusing and harassing women, that he was backed by a system. And that is why they were unable to do anything for fear of losing their ability to even have a career in soccer. So those kind of power imbalances are really present through many of these issues and cases that come up. And we have to understand it. And really, the policies and practices need to balance out those imbalances.
Well, it's been 30 years since you testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I think the popular perception is that there's been significant progress against gender violence in the intervening time. Although I have to tell you, the Kavanaugh hearing demonstrated that things haven't changed that much. In your view, what has and hasn't changed since 1991?
I think we have greater public awareness. The public reaction to the Kavanaugh hearing was very different from the reaction to the Thomas hearing. Initially, after the Thomas hearing, 70% of the people were on record as saying that they didn't believe my testimony and that Thomas should be confirmed. And that included women and men in the surveys. But in 2018, at the end of the Kavanaugh hearing, Christine Blasey Ford was seen as credible. And people believe that the Senate made a mistake in moving Kavanaugh's name forward. Now, in my case, public sentiment has changed. And that's one way that I measure progress. I mean, granted, it's personal, but it also, I think it's important to know that there's been a greater awareness. There's been better information. People came forward with their complaints. They started telling their stories. There have been protests and on college campuses, and there's been more research. So we know more now than we did. And I think that's what shifted public sentiment. And then when Me Too happened in 2017, and all of those 19 million tweets really had an impact on people so that this idea that, you know, it's just a few bad apples out there in our workforces or on our street, you know, was proven to be wrong. That is not the case, that we have an endemic problem that we need to address. And that was made very clear in 2017 with Me Too.
You know, what hasn't changed since 1991? Has it been our institution's reaction to when an accuser steps forward? Do you think that's changed much?
Yeah, well, that you're exactly, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what our institutional reaction, our leadership's ownership of the problem and an acknowledgement that it is existing, it's existing within their institutions, and commitment to actually change their own procedures to address it. It's like they keep thinking they can keep going back to the same processes, but that's not addressing, that's not eliminating the problem. The numbers are still embarrassingly high, and it's more than just an embarrassment. It's an indication of the kind of harm that is going on. One other really urgent call for change is the fact that intimate partner violence, there's an estimate of 10 million victims per year. This was before 2020 when the 10 million number was calculated. During the pandemic, during lockdown, people were at home. What we found was that domestic violence, intimate partner violence surged as people were together in their homes, which says to me that we now should take note of the fact that we have people who are living in their homes in fear. And it only takes something like a pandemic to expose the risk that they really are under in terms of their own safety and well-being.
Early in the book, you quote a head of operations, I believe it's for the World Bank, who says This is our invisible pandemic, gender violence.
And I think it is invisible because people want to think of it as personal and private, as opposed to a public issue. But it's not only hurting the individuals, it's hurting communities, it's hurting institutions, it's undermining trust in our offices like the court and our elected officials. And strikingly, it's hurting our military. And those stories are tragic. You know, I've had individuals from the military who serve as support for victims of sexual assault come to my events, and they want the public to know what kind of strain that they work under, because this problem is so big in our military. So I know we have a lot of work to do. And it does sound, I'm sure, to somebody who's listening, that I think that, you know, we're hopeless. I don't believe that. I think if we can really check our own approach to victims and survivors and realize that the problem that they are experiencing has an impact on us all, I think we will be one step closer to solving the problems. But I also think that then we have to be proactive and urge our leaders in all places, our government leaders, our CEOs of our companies, the presidents of the universities, principals in our school systems and superintendents in our school system, to own this problem, to change the processes, and to recognize that it's their responsibility to keep their constituents safe.
My guest today is Anita Hill. She's a university professor of social policy, law, and women and gender studies at Brandeis University. It was 30 years ago this fall when she testified at the Senate Judiciary's confirmation hearings to elevate Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. Her new book is titled Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. It's published by Viking. She'll be participating in a virtual event tonight through Magic City Books in conversation with Gloria Steinem. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Before we move on to a couple of other issues, I do want to ask, you mentioned Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony in 2018 at the Kavanaugh confirmation. Your reaction, it seemed to demonstrate that the Senate hasn't learned much. And as you write, you said the Senate wanted to make it a she said, he said situation. How could it have been done differently, in your view?
Well, one thing in particular, the investigation into Christine Blasey Ford's complaint was limited. The FBI was told, according to news reports, that they should only talk to Justice Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh at the time, and Dr. Ford. They should not look into all of the other information, what was happening in the context, other individuals who had complained about inappropriate behavior on the judge's part. I mean, that seems to be is set up directly to create a he said, she said situation. And one of the things that you noted earlier is that we have this big power differential that, you know, the president is behind the candidate. He has controlled the investigation to limit the amount of information that the public is going to be made aware of. I mean, that is really is sort of at the root of part of why we can't get more individuals to come forward, because they see that the system and the deck is stacked against them. Yeah. And so that's one of the problems that was clear in 2018. That alone, I think, a change in how these complaints, when they come to the Senate Judiciary Committee, are investigated, is that some change in that process needs to take place if people are ever going to have any confidence in the outcomes that are reached by the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I want to shift our focus to the Me Too movement. Again, there's a perception of progress, but you write that gender-based violence has continued to exist for generations and will continue until we shed a persistent myth that one day there will be a generation that will no longer tolerate it. Why is this idea not credible, in your view?
Well, because, first of all, no generation is going to be monolithic. I mean, there are always going to be people who don't think it's a problem, and there will be people who, in any generation, who do think it's a problem. You know, and so, and that's proven to be true of the millennials today. So, you know, I think the figure is like 30, maybe 40% of people said that they were not convinced that there should be racial and gender equality in all things and in our lives.
Wow.
So here we are putting our hope on the sentiments of individuals who are not all one and the same. And we think that it's somehow that's ultimately going to happen. I just don't believe it's going to happen. But secondly, the problem is that every generation inherits the practices that are flawed. And they go into systems where they get rewarded through these flawed processes. And so it's really up to us to change those processes. Those of us who are now in power to change those processes, we can't wait for another generation to do it. If we're just going to hand them the same problems over and over again, and the culture is slow to change, and nobody's bothered with changing the practices and processes that protect the problem. So I think that's really why I say that this idea of a generation changing things like by evolution is a flawed idea. We've got to be more proactive and take responsibility.
Does it let the institutions in control now basically off the hook?
It does. It does. If you don't call them on it, it lets them off the hook. You know, in the book, I jokingly say, you know, the baby boomers, our generation, my generation, I'm not sure what yours is,
yes,
but my generation was supposed to be the generation that changed everything, right?
Yeah.
And you know, we now know that many of those people in our generation have been accused, credibly accused, of the kind of behavior that we were supposed to fix. So, you know, I don't have much hope in that. And I agree that it just takes people off the hook. That it allows us to punt and say, well, it's somebody else's problem. It's not ours.
I want to ask you, you recount many stories throughout the book. The name of the book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. But you recount a story that occurred at the University of Oklahoma during your time as a professor there. It occurred in their women's soccer program. You said you heard nothing about it, even though you were teaching there and a member of the athletics council. And it was a pretty despicable hazing incident directly involving the coach and a player. What does this say about our system's ability to end these incidents, and what does that say to victims?
Well, what it says, something speaks volume about, is the fact that it could remain hidden. That, you know, you quoted earlier the official who said that gender-based violence is our hidden pandemic. Incidents can be hidden. And even on a college campus, they can be kept quiet, not raised to level of significance. And unless we are willing to have an open conversation about the problems that exist in our different institutions, as long as we try to hide them and pretend that that the institution is better off reputationally if all of these things stay out of the news. Instead of confronting them and resolving them, we're not going to make progress.
Yeah. Your final chapter looks at how every institution of American life needs to reexamine its commitment to ending gender-based violence and harassment. And you say that begins with government. And you have a nice little set of statistics. 3 out of the last 5 presidents have been accused of behavior ranging from rape to unwanted touching. 2 Supreme Court justices accused of sexual assault and harassment. Unknown number of Congress members have been accused, because those remain secret for the most part. Numerous military assaults and harassments. How do we bring accountability first to government and then to some of the other institutions of American life?
Well, one of the things that I have learned from doing work in this area is that change starts from the top. And that's why I go on in the chapter to make a plea to President Biden to be the leader of that change, to acknowledge the problem, commit resources to address it. And that means throughout the federal government, through all of the agencies that can have an impact on this issue, not just the EEOC or the Department of Education, to bring in survivors and victims to help inform decisions about what should happen, to help balance out that power imbalance that typically happens when rules are put in place. And so I think if we have a government that models change, then you have a government that's more effective at demanding change from private corporations.
Good thoughts. The name of the book is Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. Anita Hill, it's been my great pleasure. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Anita Hill is a university professor of social policy, law, and women's and gender study at Brandeis University. 30 years ago, she testified before the Senate Judiciary Confirmation Hearing to elevate Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, and has been a leader against gender violence ever since. Her new book is titled Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender Violence. It's published by Viking. She'll be participating in a virtual event tonight through Magic City Books in conversation with Gloria Steinem. That takes place tonight at 7. You can learn more at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.